Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon had a relationship that lasted nearly two decades. It survived despite perceived insults, misunderstandings, and the differences in their ages and temperaments. They brought out the best and the worst in each other, and their association had a lasting impact on American politics. In his new book, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage, Jeffrey Frank, the deputy editor of the Washington Post Outlook section, has taken a fresh look at these two compelling figures. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jeffrey Frank to our show today. Hello.
Hi, nice to be here.
Haven't all of your previous books been novels?
They have.
So did
plus one translation with my wife from the Danish Hans Christian Andersen stories.
So did you see the relationship of these two men as the sort of stuff that novels are made of?
Partly. It's a story that's always fascinated me because it's such a natural narrative. It starts at the end of the Second World War, and it takes us to the end of the Cold War and the whole century. Ike was born in 1890. Nixon died in 1994. And it also has the sort of great narrative quality of being of having a family story with a beginning and ending.
And did you in doing this find a story that had been overlooked or misunderstood in past histories of that time?
What I found was I thought everyone who's ever written about either one of these men has written about this relationship. You can't avoid it. But no one has just sort of singled this out and tried to drill down deep into it. And by doing so, I sort of found a lot of things I never knew about, just things that were going on out of view, things that were going on at certain times of when Eisenhower was very sick, for example, and Nixon was the young vice president who didn't know what might be hitting him next.
In 1952, Dwight D. Eisenhower was nominated as the Republican candidate for president. Hadn't the Democrats also wooed him to be a candidate?
They'd been after Eisenhower for years. In 1945, Harry Truman, after the Potsdam Conference, he turned to Eisenhower and said, "I'll do anything I can for you, including giving you the presidency." In 1948, the Democrats would have loved him to run, and as time went on, even people from the Americans for Democratic Action, Democrats like Jimmy Roosevelt, FDR's son, wanted Eisenhower to be a Democrat. Eisenhower did not feel like a Democrat. He was a Republican, but an internationalist Republican, not like the Taft wing of the party.
He was what we would call today a liberal Republican. They don't exist anymore.
Yeah, except for his domestic views, which were not terribly liberal.
What made him want to get into politics after his military career and then a very comfortable civilian life at Columbia University?
He always said that he didn't want to be. He really was. I think deep down he was very ambitious and sort of loved the idea. But it was acclamation. He was dragged into this in a way. He was sitting in Paris when he won the New Hampshire primary.
And didn't he have a kind of a negative opinion about politicians?
Yes,
politicians.
He didn't like professional politicians, and he didn't. Like a man like Tom Dewey, who was the governor of New York, and was very, very influential on getting Ike to run. I kind of despised him. He was a professional politician.
Now, you said that he was not like Robert Taft or Joe McCarthy, for that matter. No. But was he typical of many Republicans in Washington at the time?
No, they didn't. Not really. I mean, he really was sui generis. He was a five-star general, and at a time when there were four five-star generals in the entire country, and there are none today. And there was simply no one like him, and he was a national hero in a way we don't have today too.
How did his time in the military influence his views on government?
Well, I think being in the military, he wasn't familiar with the problems of real people. He had health care all his life, he had housing all his life. He didn't have to worry about a lot of the things that people who are not in the military have to worry about. And I think that influenced him. It really made him blind to the problems that people face, unlike Nixon.
And it affected the way he treated the people under him.
Yeah, they liked him. I mean, the people who worked for him liked him. I think they all felt like staff. I mean, and I think Nixon was. I mean, Eisenhower had sort of great affection for some of his young aides. A man named Gabriel Howey, for example, who was a New York banker, who was a very bright guy. And Ike was very, very helpful to these people and liked them.
But I get the feeling from reading your book that he also felt, well, you issue orders and people
that's
carry
right.
them out.
That's
I'm the
right.
general, and
right.
they don't have five stars. I'm the one with the five stars.
It never changed. I talked to a man who met Ike in the 60s when Ike was ghostwriting an article, and I said, "What was he like then?" He said, he just goes all five star on you.
My guest is Jeffrey Frank, whose latest book is Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When did Richard Nixon see Eisenhower for the first time?
The first time was in 1950. Eisenhower was president of Columbia University, and he'd been invited to give what they called to give a lakeside. That's a lakeside talk at the very exclusive men's club, the Bohemian Grove, north of San Francisco. And Nixon was running for the U.S. Senate. He was running what turned into a very nasty campaign against Helen Gahagan Douglas, and both of them were invited by
Herbert. Called her the Pink Lady.
Pink Lady came. Came from actually her Democratic primary. Uh-huh. Nixon said she's pink right down to her underwear. It was a very nasty campaign. And both of them were invited out by Herbert Hoover, the former president, who was a big fan of the Bohemian Grove and was sort of the head of the caveman camp, as they called it. He was the number one caveman. They all called him the chief.
And the Bohemian Grove was membership.
It was people were invited. Yeah, I mean, it still exists. And at that time, they would have businessmen, show business people like Edgar Bergen and Bing Crosby and so on, and businessmen. The summer that Nixon was invited, Hoover said, "Why don't we get Conrad Hilton to come? Maybe we'll get some good hotel ideas here," and so on.
Did Eisenhower and Nixon have any more contact with each other this Bohemian Grove thing and the convention in 1952?
One more time, Nixon went over as a senator on sort of visit to the New World Health Organization in Geneva, and on the way he said, "Well, he went to visit Eisenhower." I think by then he sensed Eisenhower was sort of the coming thing. I mean, it was clear to a lot of people, and particularly a man with Nixon's antenna.
Nixon had been a military man.
Yeah, Nixon was.
Did he see Eisenhower as one of his heroes?
Very much so. The first time he saw Eisenhower, he was sort of awestruck. He just happened to be finishing up his Navy career with working on ending some defense contracts. He was on the 20th floor on Church Street in downtown Manhattan when Eisenhower was coming through for his Victory in Europe parade. 4 million New Yorkers turned out to see him, and one of them was Richard M. Nixon.
Go ahead.
No, he was in the Navy, and he was, and Eisenhower was very much a hero to him. Eisenhower was the man who had defeated the Nazis, the man who was the supreme commander of the Allied armies.
And then Nixon worked for the Army for a little while, didn't he?
He was just on his way out of the Navy. He was doing this, but then he was gone, and then Nixon had to find something to do after that, and then by sort of deus ex machina, he got an invitation to run for Congress in California.
He was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer, yes.
Had he political ambitions at that
Not,
point?
I think he probably did. He'd been an assistant city attorney in Whittier, and he'd been asked if he wanted to run for the state assembly. That was never going to happen. And he was a natural about. But this thing was a big surprise. Having a chance to run for Congress, and not only run for Congress, but run against a whale, a five-term Democratic incumbent who was very popular in the district.
But it did set the tone for a lot of campaigns that followed. Not just his, but all over the country.
Well, that was, you mean, but what do you mean? You mean because of the sort of Red Scare stuff that was going on? The Red Scare stuff was going on, and very much so, but it didn't really reach its zenith until 1950 when Joe McCarthy made his famous speech in Wheeling and had the name of 205 communists in the State Department, or perhaps 57 communists, whatever it happened to be that day.
So Nixon was elected to Congress.
Yes, by a pretty big margin.
And then how many terms did he serve before he went into the Senate?
He served two terms. The second, he was basically unopposed in 1948. In 1950, some of his advisors says, "Don't do it. Don't try this." But Nixon thought he'd go after it. He was already a national name. He had been on the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he was probably which was a pretty disreputable committee to begin with. But Nixon was probably the most conscientious member, and he tried to follow the rules. And his big thing was getting Alger Hiss, who had passing secrets to the Soviets. Alger Hiss had been the president of the Carnegie Foundation and so on.
Well, as I understand it, the jury is still out as to whether Alger Hiss actually did it or not.
There's a huge jury on that. I don't want to get into that.
But whether he did or didn't, it sure helped Nixon's career.
It did. He was identified as the man who got Alger Hiss and as a World War II veteran, and then of course he was running against the Pink Lady, as you said.
And then who did he run against for the Senate seat?
That was Helen Douglas, who had won her primary.
Married to a movie star, Melvin Douglas.
And I say it was. I think that was his nastiest race. People who hated Nixon sometimes said, oh, the Democrats are after me because I got Alger Hiss. No, it was because of that race. They still talked about it. They talked about it when I was growing up. Oh, the Helen Hagen Douglas race. And it was his low point as a campaigner. I talked to a member of his who had worked with him in the House of Representatives. I met her actually about a month before she died. A woman named Dorothy Cox Donnelly. She said, "Yeah." I said, "What was that like?" She said, "Well, we knew it was a sordid affair."
Was it during that race that he was given the nickname Tricky Dick?
Yeah, she gave it. She gave it to him. Mrs. Douglas gave it to him, and it stuck.
So he wins the Senate.
Yeah.
Race, and then at the time of the Republican convention, 1952. He's a first-term senator from California.
He is. A first-term senator, but it's sort of a known national quantity this time. And what he had going for him was, in particular, Thomas Dewey, some Easterners. There were others too who sort of Dewey had seen him speak at a New York dinner here, and he had said to him, you know, Dick, I think you could be president someday if you lose some weight and so on. He was so impressed by him, and he thought that he could be on a ticket with Dwight D. Eisenhower.
So Nixon at that time was overweight?
No, but he was just Dewey's way of speaking, though. Nixon looked pretty good. Nixon was a sort of terrific speaker. He had some of the habits that began to drive people crazy. On the one hand, on the other hand, and all that.
But he had a beautiful voice, a wonderful baritone.
He did. The Time magazine called it a buttery baritone. And I have some of the speeches he gave when he was very young, before he was even in the Senate. And you could hear almost evangelical, sort of purr to his voice then.
So he didn't have that kind of awkward aspect to his voice that I associate with him later?
I think it came in later. The more sort of the closer he got to higher and higher office, the more cautious he got. And that's what we all began to hear.
How similar was his background to Eisenhower's? Family, his educational background?
Yeah, in a sort of strange way. They were so extraordinarily similar, even though they couldn't have been more different. I mean, Eisenhower was a Midwesterner, and Nixon, of course, was from California, Orange County. Eisenhower was her father had a sort of short-tempered father who didn't do very well in business. His mother was very religious, and she actually became a Jehovah's Witness. Nixon had a very short-tempered father who did not do very well in business, and his mother was a very devout Quaker. So they had that in common, and both of them had also had sort of horrible personal experiences that were similar too.
Were they religious men?
I don't know. I don't know. Eisenhower, for all of his putting God into the Pledge of Allegiance, I don't think he liked going to church very much, and he became a Presbyterian. And Nixon was a Quaker, but he would go to church in New York at the Peale Church here in New York, the Marble Collegiate Church.
So when Eisenhower decided to choose Nixon as his running mate, they'd only really met face to face once.
Well, twice. Let's say when Nixon had gone to the World Health Organization, he dropped by to see Eisenhower at NATO, and I say that was Nixon sort of sensing, I think, that Eisenhower had a future. But yeah, that's not only that. I think you used the phrase when Eisenhower chose Nixon. No, when the more accurate thing is probably when Nixon was chosen by Eisenhower, but it wasn't an active choosing. Eisenhower was basically given a list of names, and Eisenhower sort of picked Nixon for sort of obvious reasons you can see this, now.
The same reasons that Mitt Romney chose Paul Ryan as his running mate.
Yeah,
to take care of the right flank of the party.
That's right, but even more so, Nixon. Paul Ryan really wasn't a big geographic help. I mean, Romney was what, Michigan, Wisconsin, or whatever Romney was from. But Nixon was a Westerner. Nixon, like Paul Ryan was young. He was 39 years old. Ike was 62, and he was a sort of old 62 too.
Did Eisenhower have an opinion that we know of about Nixon at the time?
Oh, he thought he was a fine young man. I mean, he never spoke unpleasantly about Nixon. He always was loyal to Nixon, and he always thought Nixon was loyal to him. It's just that he didn't treat being loyal to someone in the terms of sort of saying nice things about him and treating him that way is not quite the same thing.
Is that true later?
Yeah.
Somebody asked Eisenhower if Nixon's going to make a good president, and could he name one thing that he achieved during the time they were in the White House. Also, Eisenhower thought of dumping him. We'll get to all of that later. It seems to me that he what he said was rather hurtful.
It was terribly hurtful. If you want to mention that with the one you're referring to, in the summer of 1960, when Nixon had his party's nomination to the race against John F. Kennedy, at the end of a press conference in late August, Eisenhower was asked by a Time magazine reporter, and this is a period when Nixon was referring to the Nixon-Eisenhower administration, can you think of one positive or one major contribution Nixon has made? And Eisenhower just said, well, give me a week, I'll think of one. And the reporters laughed, end of press conference. And that was terribly damaging. It never quite went away during the campaign.
Well, why do you think he would say something so hurtful?
I don't know. I mean, there was something deep down. I think deep down he didn't really feel happy about Nixon being president. On the other hand, he was loyal to him as a Republican, as his vice president.
Did he like JFK?
No. He thought he was completely incompetent. And he thought that Nixon, he would say things like that. I'm not sure that Dick has the maturity to beat president. I'm not sure Dick is presidential timber. He would say these privately.
He also probably was angry with JFK for talking about things like the missile gap.
Yeah, he also turned to really, really dislike Nelson Rockefeller for the same reason.
My guest is Jeffrey Frank, who's written a book called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jeffrey Frank, who was a senior editor at The New Yorker, the deputy editor of the Washington Post Outlook section, and the author of four novels, now a work of nonfiction called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And when I look at the body language of the two of them on the cover of your book, it says an awful lot. They're sitting side by side, but they look like two people on the subway, two strangers on the subway.
Indeed.
Might look if you took a picture of them.
Indeed. Yeah, I'd never seen that picture before. My editor at Simon & Schuster, Priscilla Payton, found it, and I said, my God, it's perfect. It really gets it. It really gets it.
Yeah. So what? So was there the relationship always uncomfortable? Is it because just of the nature of their personalities, or also because of their various differences?
I think, yeah, they were always uncomfortable. There was always this huge stature gap. I'd mentioned that Ike is a 5-star general, and that extra star is a big deal. Petraeus was a 4-star general. And the difference, and that star is between the man who defeated the Nazis in Europe and led the Allied Expeditionary Force and the man who led the surge in Iraq. That's the difference. Nixon was a Navy lieutenant, and Nixon always felt as if he even once wrote, I was like a junior officer going to see the general.
And Nixon is a guy who made a lot of money winning at poker.
Yes, yeah, he did.
It's a very different kind of sensibility. Yeah, yeah. So how did Nixon learn that he'd been chosen as Ike's running mate?
Well, he was in Chicago at the convention, and he was getting there were stories in the paper that he was on the list, and his campaign manager, a guy named Murray Chotiner, who had helped him through the Helen Douglas campaign, was there. Nixon was not playing quite straight with Governor Earl Warren, because he was part of the California delegation, and Earl Warren, who later became the Supreme Court Chief Justice.
And a
Republican. And he sort of imagined if there had been a deadlock at the convention between Eisenhower and Senator Robert Taft, who was the more conservative Republican, he would be the one to get the nomination. So there was all kinds of things going on. But Nixon kept hearing it might be him. He met with some of Eisenhower's advisors, and then he got the word. He was in his underwear in his hotel room, sweating because it was a very hot day in Chicago. And then the phone rang.
Now Taft had been the only other serious candidate other than Eisenhower at that convention.
Yeah, and he was actually.
So would he have taken the vice presidency?
Would Taft have taken it?
Yeah,
I think he definitely would have taken it. And he was, in fact, he was ahead in delegates when they got there. As it turned out, it was very fortunate. Taft died 6 months later of cancer. But what
was the first meeting between the two of them as running mates like?
Well, Nixon went to his hotel room at the Blackstone, and it was sort of general. I'd love to be on the ticket, and I hope you'll help me. Very formal back and forth, almost as if it were scripted. Mrs. Eisner had a very severe toothache because she didn't come out to say hello. Sherman Adams, who was the governor of New Hampshire and became Eisenhower's campaign manager and then later became his chief of staff at the White House, was the one who sort of took him in. And that was kind of it. They didn't talk for very long. I'd love you to have you on the ticket. Thank you, General. I'd love to serve.
So it was very formal.
Yeah, we'll have a great crusade was sort of the spirit.
And it kind of sounds like that's the way it was all along
That was it. I mean, Nixon went to see him in Fraser, Colorado, where Eisenhower had a very good friend outside Denver, a ranch. I tried to teach him fly fishing. There's some wonderful footage. You can see it. I have the URL in my index, and you can see Nixon trying to cast a rod and catching the hook on his jacket, and it's not going very well. And that was it. That was basically it. But then all hell broke loose a little bit later.
Well, they had different campaign styles.
They did. And in those days, communicating, there were no cell phones. You couldn't. They were on different trains. You couldn't just pick up the phone in one train and call the other train. Everything was much slow motion then.
When you say all hell broke loose, it was a scandal that almost sunk Nixon's career.
Right. I'm not sure it was even a scandal, but Nixon was being supported by a group of California millionaires, and actually he'd been asked about it. He'd been on a Meet the Press, and a reporter asked him, "I heard about this fund." He said, "Yeah, I talked to Dana Smith, who's been raising the money. It's paying for some office expenses and travel back and forth." And Nixon kind of shrugged it off. But then the New York Post, which was a Dorothy Schiff liberal paper, not the Rupert Murdoch paper we have today, had a big front page headline that said Nixon's secret fund! ! And then that's when I say all hell broke loose.
And he was kind of asked to step down. He decided he convinced Eisenhower and the rest of the Republican Party that that wasn't necessarily the best option.
It never got to the point of asking him to step down. Eisenhower wanted him to step down, but never said so directly, which is one reason why if Eisenhower had said "get out of the ticket," Nixon would have had to do it.
And Nixon gave the checker speech in his defense.
That's what saved him.
Now, watching that, it really does feel rather artificial.
Yeah.
I've seen it in years since.
Yeah, me too.
It doesn't seem like the most authentic speech I've ever seen. Why was it so effective at the time? Do you think people wanted to believe him?
You're looking at it, as we all do, through the eyes of the Nixon that we got to know in later life. But if you look, but try to put yourself back into 1952, and here, you're watching television. You have these little black and white sets. The Milton Berle show is over. Here's this man facing scandal. He sits there with his very attractive wife next to him, or not, sort of downset, and says, I want to speak to you tonight, as a candidate for the vice presidency. And he opens up his life. He opens up his mortgage and his debts and everything, which he humiliates his wife. And it worked. People, even Mamie Eisenhower fell for it.
So Eisenhower had a positive reaction.
Not terribly, but Eisenhower was particularly annoyed because Nixon basically said, I want you to write to the Republican National Committee, as if the Republican National Committee and not the presidential candidate had the choice in the matter.
You talked about Eisenhower trying to teach Nixon fly fishing. What about golfing? Because Eisenhower was an avid golfer.
Yeah, now, Eisenhower was.
People complained that he was often golfing when he should have been running the country.
Yeah, he managed to run the country somehow, or at least run foreign policy, which was his great strength. But his other sort of avocation was bridge, which Nixon never learned. Eisenhower didn't teach Nixon golf, but Nixon was determined to learn golf. I talked to a man who caddied for Nixon in Matoloki, New Jersey one summer, and Nixon was just going to learn this game. His sheer determination. He was never a great-looking golfer. His swing wasn't great, but boy, he learned the game.
Now, the role of the vice president at that time was rather limited.
Very much so.
Did Eisenhower give Nixon any special things to do?
That was Eisenhower's great favor to Nixon. Even though Eisenhower might not have been terribly fond of Nixon, he did some huge favors for him. He was very conscious of Harry Truman becoming president and not knowing anything about the job. Harry Truman, I think, had met Roosevelt. I mean, he knew him, but he'd had one lunch with him after he was vice president. So he sent Nixon on a round-the-world trip in the fall of 1953, which was a great thing for Nixon. He got to traveled all through Asia and got to meet all these people, including the Emperor of Vietnam and
but
so on.
Didn't he also face Yankee go home signs?
Not at all. Not then. He faced them. He faced them in South America later on. No, he was a huge hit. And I mean, in the book, I quote some of the reporting that was done by the New York Times, for example. I think there was one phrase: they liked this young big American and his cheerful outlook and so on. Very interesting view of Nixon at that period.
Well, he was arriving as a Cold Warrior. Was Ike as much a Cold Warrior as Nixon?
Not the same. Yeah, I mean, Ike, the, both of them, both, Ike was the one who used the phrase the domino theory to talk about, you know, if you lose one country in Asia, you lose them all and so on. But when Nixon toured through Asia, he wasn't really seen as a Cold Warrior. When he went to Vietnam, he was very aware of the of what was going on there with the French being kicked out. But he also said, in his, I looked at some of his private notes, and he said, you know, the people, if the French can't, probably the commies best able to govern this place. I mean, he sort of saw the future.
What about the views on the civil rights movement? Weren't Nixon and Jackie Robinson, the great Brooklyn Dodgers second baseman, friends?
They were friends. They were friends. And Jackie Robinson was a big supporter of Nixon. Nixon had first met him in the lobby of one of the hotels during the 1952 convention. And Nixon remembered a play that Jackie Robinson had made when he was a football star at UCLA.
And they're both from Southern California.
Yeah, yeah. And so they were. And Nixon's record on civil rights was excellent, first rate. And Eisenhower, he did the right thing when he had to do it. He followed the Constitution, but Eisenhower hated the Brown v. Board of Education decision.
And later, Nixon winds up being behind the Southern strategy.
Yeah, he did.
So did he change his attitude about civil rights, or was it simply a realpolitik decision?
I think it was a realpolitik decision. All of his to quote the famous John Mitchell, he could almost say, "Watch what we do, not what we say." And Nixon was sort of Nixon was always good on the issue.
Affirmative action.
Sure, the Philadelphia Plan. The Southern schools were desegregated under Nixon. They didn't use the word "we're going to integrate Southern schools," but they desegregated the Southern schools. George Shultz will talk about that. And it's very interesting. Martin Luther King Jr. said about him once, "Well, I think it's because he was raised a Quaker without prejudice." Which, by the way, doesn't explain some of the really horrible things he said on the tapes, but that's another story.
Well, he may have had good feelings about African Americans, but not Jews.
That's very complicated, because when you think of all his close friends who were Jews, Murray Chotiner, who saved his career in the 50s, was Jewish. His Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, was Jewish. When he practiced law in New York, his closest friend at Nixon Mudge was Len Garment, who's Jewish. Len Garment was asked about it once. He said, "Well, he's a little bit anti-Semitic." But there again, Golda Meir thought he was the best friend Israel had. So it's there again, watch what we do, not what we say.
My guest is Jeffrey Frank. His book, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Why did Eisenhower want to dump Nixon from the ticket when he was running for the second term?
People think Eisenhower was completely sincere. He asked Nixon to take another job. He wanted Nixon to get some managerial experience. He said, become Secretary of Defense. And he wanted to bring someone else in.
Who?
Yeah, I mean, well, he had that sort of man crush on a man named Bob Anderson, who had been the Deputy Secretary of Defense and became his Treasury Secretary. I can't explain that. People who saw Anderson in action think it was just he was a great briefer. He was great at meetings, very bright, very sharp, a Texan, and therefore he knew Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson and so on. But he would have settled for some others. And actually, there was a long plotting meeting with the Republican National Committee chairman about how they're going to get rid of Nixon.
So did Nixon have to convince him to keep him on the ticket?
Well, Nixon was a very, very good infighter. And Nixon, among the other things Nixon did, was just wait him out. He knew that Eisenhower was never going to just say, "I want to get rid of Nixon," because that wasn't Eisenhower's style, indirection. So a friend got Nixon into the New Hampshire primary, even though Nixon wasn't running for anything, and Nixon came in second to Eisenhower. And in a huge write-in vote that was kind of orchestrated, and that was like a signal that the Nixon base was out there, and you better take care, you better pay attention to it.
And then when they campaigned, Nixon, in effect, was Eisenhower's hatchet man, wasn't he?
He was. He certainly was.
Good cop, bad cop.
He certainly was in 1952, where he went over the top and said things like, he spoke about Dean Acheson's College of Cowardly Containment. Dean Acheson was Truman's Secretary of State. And one of the worst things he said, he said the Democrats were traitor to the principles of the Democratic Party, which Truman heard as being traitors, never forgave Nixon for it. In 1954, it was sort of a completely over-the-top campaign, really bad. And after that, he got better. Nixon saw that if he was going to have a future, he had to behave more like an Adlai Stevenson than a Joe McCarthy.
Well, then you mentioned Eisenhower's concern about Nixon not being prepared to become president. Eisenhower wound up he had a heart attack.
Yes, and so that was going to say, by the time 1956 came, Nixon had been really tested in that way. So Eisenhower was critically ill for a while, and Nixon had to step in and do it in a very delicate way.
Was Nixon still concerned with what Eisenhower thought of him even after they left office?
Yeah, I mean, in a funny way, that never left. He always wanted Eisenhower's approval. They never lost touch. He would, after he lost the election in 1960, Eisenhower went to his winter home in Palm Desert. Nixon was in Los Angeles. They began for the first time to socialize. It was almost as if they almost seemed like friends. Eisenhower said, "Please come out and visit. Let's have golf." And then they would write to each other. It was the relationship began to change.
And Eisenhower had to learn what a normal life was like. He didn't even know how to use a rotary phone.
When he left the White House, would someone do this, turn this damn phone on for him, tell me how to run this thing?
Because aides had done everything for him.
He didn't know how to tolls at turnpikes, frozen orange juice, completely flummoxed him.
So Eisenhower lost the election. Nixon lost the election.
Yeah.
But then, of course, 1968, he wins.
Yeah.
What did Eisenhower think when Nixon was elected?
I mean, in 68?
Yeah.
Well, Eisenhower was pretty close to on his deathbed then.
But the families were already connecting.
Yeah,
that time, wasn't Julie marrying Eisenhower's grandson, David?
This sort of started. Yeah, this all started in 1966. Nixon's comeback, in a way, was the off-year election of 66. He campaigned for all these Republicans. All the one, Julie and David showed up at the victory party. There was their second date. Julie at Smith, David at Amherst, and then in 67 they announced their engagement. And then all of this happened in the last year of Nixon, Julie and David got married, and Eisenhower died in the spring of 69.
And that marriage has lasted a long time. Obviously,
over
it was
40 years.
A much better mating than Eisenhower and Nixon.
And Julie Dixon Eisenhower worked for Barack Obama in 2004.
Ike and
2008, I'm sorry.
Ike and Dick is Jeffrey Frank's latest book, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage, is a subtitle. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
It was a real pleasure.